Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. This is the radio program and podcast that helps you to learn and improve your American English skills. We come to you every day with interesting and important stories from around the world. We always present these stories in a way that makes them easy to understand. We speak more slowly than normal, and we use a small number of simple words. That is a big help if English is not your first language. Today we have two stories for you. One is a bit of a history lesson from World War II. Then we have some important information about recent problems between North and South Korea. We are looking to the East for this edition of As It Is from VOA, the Voice of America. Let's get started with part one. World War II ended 70 years ago this week. On August 15, 1945, Japan surrendered to United States-led Allied forces. The war was, and remains, the deadliest military conflict in history. The Allies fought many costly battles against Japan. The bloodiest and most deadly was the Battle of Okinawa. U.S. officials said the battle was one reason they decided to use atomic weapons on Japan. They said the human cost of fighting was too high. Christopher Jones Cruz explains and helps us to remember.
The invasion of Okinawa was the last, the bloodiest, and one of the largest battles of World War II. More than 1,000 American ships and hundreds of thousands of troops were involved. The fighting lasted 82 days. Villages were destroyed and forests burned. Almost 200,000 people were killed. A small museum on a U.S. Marine base in Okinawa shows pictures and historical objects from the battle. Mark Waycaster is the curator of the museum's Battle of Okinawa area. He says Japanese General Mitsuru Ushijima's plan was to hurt the morale and strength of the Americans. His goal was not to win.
His intentions is to bleed the American forces so bad that the United States sues for peace.
Many American and Japanese troops were killed or injured in Okinawa. Japanese forces fought fiercely. Some fought to the death, refusing to surrender even when they knew they could not win. This was one reason U.S. officials gave for their decision to drop atomic bombs on the city of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Today on Okinawa, many Japanese still remember the battle. The fighting caused the deaths of almost one-third of the civilians who lived on the island. Some Japanese military areas are preserved as memorials. The Himeyuri Peace Museum tells the story of about 200 Japanese schoolgirls. They were forced to work as medical aides for the Japanese military. Many died in the fighting. Shima Bukuru Yoshiko was seriously injured during the fighting. She said Japanese officials warned the girls that the Americans would rape and then kill them. She says she was told American soldiers were devils. But she said an American soldier saved her life. She says, I saw the soldier's face and he looked nice and said, I'm going to help you. Many people remember or learned about the deaths and damage resulting from the war. Many Okinawans are pacifists, and they gather often to speak against violence. They are unhappy about the presence of American troops on Okinawa, and they oppose efforts by conservatives in Japan to strengthen the country's military. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
You are listening to The Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. South Korean officials are accusing the North Korean military of illegally entering the country and planting deadly landmines. The landmine seriously injured two soldiers on August 4th. The U.S.-led United Nations command that monitors the ceasefire between the North and South supports South Korea's finding. Three landmines exploded last Tuesday on the South Korean side of the border between North and South Korea. Eight South Korean soldiers were monitoring the area. One soldier lost both legs in the explosions. Another soldier lost one leg. South Korean officials say the North Korean military is responsible for the attack. They are urging the North to apologize for the attack and promise they will answer it. Major General Koo Hong-mo is with the South Korean Joint Chiefs of Staff. He spoke strongly against what he called the North's cowardly and despicable act. Major General Koo said the move violated agreements between South Korea and North Korea. Investigators support South Korea's claim. They say the kinds of cases and explosives used in the blast suggest the North Korean military made the landmines. They also note that the border area has many landmines, but South Korean troops often monitor the site of the explosions. As a result, they say these landmines were probably recently planted. Young Wook is a North Korea expert with the Korea Defense and Security Forum in Seoul. He says the North Korean military likely just wanted to show their strength. Mr. Young says he does not believe South Korea will answer the attack in any serious way. Mr. Young says, so from North Korea's point of view, they have nothing to lose, even if they fail. He expects South Korea to answer the landmine attacks by increasing military exercises or sending more anti-government information to the North. Mr. Young says, we can pressure North Korea by conducting massive-scale military drills or punish them by resuming psychological combat, which North Korea fears the most. However, North Korea will likely angrily deny responsibility for the attacks, and tensions in the area will rise. Earlier this year, North Korean officials objected to the UN establishing an office in Seoul to investigate human rights violations in the North.
North Korea also objects to joint military drills between South Korean and American soldiers that will begin soon. And the two countries have not been able to agree on a shared ceremony this week to honor the 70th anniversary of freedom from Japanese rule. You are listening to The Voice of America. This is Washington.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. China's highly controlled currency, the yuan, had its biggest drop in two decades Tuesday. That was followed Wednesday by a 1.6% drop in value. Chinese officials say their devaluation of the currency will let markets play a greater part in setting the value of Chinese money. However, experts say the devaluation also will help Chinese exports. By Wednesday, markets reacted to news of the decline in the yuan's value. Stock market measures in Asia were down, while stocks in the United States showed early losses. The value of the Chinese yuan has been gradually rising for 10 years. Tuesday's fall was its biggest drop since 1994. The drop also took place days after China announced that exports had fallen in July by more than 8% from the previous year. Some experts say the recent volatility in the country's stock market also has played a part. The yuan has remained largely stable against the U.S. dollar for a year, at a little over 6 yuan to the dollar. Other currencies, however, such as the euro and Japanese yen, have weakened. That has put pressure on the yuan and hurt Chinese exports. Economist Brian Jackson is with IHS Economics China Regional Service. The People's Bank of China says it is trying to make the currency more market-oriented. In the past, China would set a midpoint for trading each day, based on a group of currency exchange rates. From that point, the value could go up or down by 2%, but in many cases, officials would intervene. Now, the daily level for the range of trading is based on a group of major currencies and the value of the yuan at the close of trading the day before. China's loosening of controls on its currency has led other nations in the area to do the same. One day after China changed its method of setting its currency value, Vietnam made a similar move. Many in the U.S. Congress have accused China of keeping the value of its currency unfairly low to support its exports. However, the U.S. Treasury has said it is too early to say what the changes will mean. If China does let the market have more influence, the yuan might become a more international currency. China is seeking to get the International Monetary Fund to add the yuan to its special drawing rights, a reserve of currencies that includes the U.S. dollar, euro, Japanese yen, and British pound. And that's the Economics Report. I'm Mario Ritter.
From VOA Learning English, this is The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, we begin the story of a document that defined a nation, the United States Constitution. The 13 American colonies declared their independence from Britain in 1776. But they had to fight for that independence in a long war that followed. During that war, the states were united by an agreement called the Articles of Confederation. But the Union of 13 states was loosely organized. The Articles of Confederation created a weak central government. The document did not create courts or provide for a president or other executive to carry out laws. The Articles of Confederation did create a Congress, but that legislature had little power or money. When British General Charles Cornwallis surrendered at Yorktown, Virginia, a messenger brought the news to the Congress. But Congress could not even pay the messenger, so money had to be collected from each member. The war ended in 1783 with the Treaty of Paris. Even before then, three influential Americans had called for a change in this loose confederation of states. The three were George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, and James Madison. They urged the formation of a strong central government. George Washington commanded America's troops during the Revolution. He opposed the Articles of Confederation because they provided little support for his army. His soldiers struggled with shortages of food, warm clothing, shoes, and other supplies. Here is an actor playing George Washington in a show at the National Archives. He is talking about the Articles of Confederation.
In my mind, it prolonged the war by several years. Every time I needed men or money to prosecute the war, I had to go to 13 sovereign heads of state hat in hand. Even now, under peacetime conditions, we are like a giant with 13 heads tottering towards a cliff.
Alexander Hamilton was a young lawyer who served as an aide to General Washington during the Revolution. Hamilton called for a convention of the 13 states to create a new central government. He expressed his opinion in letters, speeches, and newspaper articles. Finally, there was James Madison. He was one of the authors of the state constitution in Virginia in 1776. When Madison, Hamilton, and Washington looked at the Articles of Confederation, they saw an unhappy picture. There were 13 governments that each tried to help themselves at the expense of the others. Each state had its own army. Nine states had their own navy. The states had these forces to protect themselves from each other. For example, Virginia passed a law which said it could seize ships that did not pay taxes to the state. Virginia did not mean ships from Great Britain or Spain. It meant ships from other states, like Maryland and Pennsylvania.
Basically, the thought was, we need a military defense structure, we need a modest army and a navy, we need to regulate trade with Europe, and individual states in a loose confederation won't do the job.
Akhil Reed Amar is a professor at Yale Law School. He says Americans realized a strong central government could improve their national security system. In 1786, representatives from Maryland and Virginia met to discuss opening land for new settlements along the Potomac River. The Potomac formed the border between those two states. The representatives agreed that the issue of settling new land was too big for just two states to decide. Someone asked, "Why not invite Delaware and Pennsylvania to help?" Someone else said, "All the states should be invited. Then they could discuss all the problems that were giving the new nation so much trouble." The idea was accepted, and a convention was set for Annapolis, Maryland. The convention opened as planned, but it was not much of a meeting. Representatives came from only five states. The men who did meet at Annapolis, however, agreed that it was a beginning. They agreed, too, that a larger convention should be called. They appointed the representative from New York, Alexander Hamilton, to put the agreement in writing. So Hamilton sent a message to the legislature of each state. He called for a convention in Philadelphia in May of the next year, 1787. The purpose of the convention, he said, would be to write a constitution for the United States. The nation was new, but the idea of a constitution was not. Law professor Akhil Reed Amar explains that the earliest settlers had formed political agreements called compacts, charters, or corporations. These agreements developed into state constitutions.
And then, in 1787-88, the idea becomes to try to continentalize, to take on a much bigger scale this idea of a written constitution setting forth the rules for how people would govern themselves, what government could do and not do, what their powers would be, and what the limits would be.
Even so, he says, Americans were not sure about creating such a constitution. Amar says they were afraid a new central government might be as arrogant and out of touch as the King of England had been. However, most people slowly came to believe that a strong central government would protect their country better than the loose union of 13 states could. Many people also believed that a constitutional convention would not succeed without George Washington. People wanted to elect him president of the convention, but Washington did not want to go. He suffered from rheumatism. His mother and sister were sick. He needed to take care of business at Mount Vernon, his farm in Virginia. And he already said he was not interested in public office. George Washington was the most famous man in America. Suppose only a few states sent representatives to the convention. Suppose it failed. Would he look foolish? Two close friends, James Madison and Edmund Randolph, urged George Washington to go to Philadelphia. He trusted them, so he said he would go as one of the representatives of Virginia. From that moment, it was clear the convention would be an important event. If George Washington would be there, it had to be important. The first delegate to arrive in Philadelphia for the convention was James Madison. Madison was 35 years old. He was short and losing his hair. He was not a good speaker, but he always knew what he wanted to say. He had read everything that had been published in English about governments, from the governments of ancient Greece to those of his own time. Madison believed the United States needed a strong central government that was more powerful than the 13 states. Madison also knew that he should not push his ideas too quickly, so he planned his work quietly. He came to the convention with hundreds of books and papers. He was prepared to answer any question about government that any other representative might ask him. Madison asked the other delegates from Virginia to also arrive early. He wanted to enter the convention with a plan for a strong central government. He was sure no other state would do this. Two Virginia delegates came early as requested. Together, the three men worked on Madison's plan. The only other delegates there were from Pennsylvania. Nobody seemed worried that there were no delegates from the other 11 states. After all, it took 2 weeks to ride a horse to Philadelphia from New Hampshire in the Northeast, and it took as long as 3 weeks to get to Philadelphia from Georgia in the South. Finally, the other delegates started coming a few at a time. 55 men in all from 12 states. Pennsylvania sent the most delegates, 8. Rhode Island sent none. A few of the delegates were very old, but many were in their 20s or 30s. The average age of the delegates was just 43 years. From the moment the convention began, Madison kept careful records of everything everyone said. He never stopped writing. If it were not for James Madison, we would know little of what happened at that historic meeting in Philadelphia in 1787. Later, Madison explained how he did it. He wrote, "I sat in front of the president of the convention. All the other delegates were on my right and on my left. I could hear everything the president said. I could hear all the words of every delegate. I made notes only I could understand. Then, at night in my room, I wrote out completely all the speeches and acts. I attended the convention every day. I was there as long as the delegates were meeting and talking." James Madison's full records of the convention were not published until 30 years later. The Constitutional Convention will be our story next week. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.